ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do you want to know who's really responsible for Donald Trump becoming president? It's Alan Funt. Yes. He's the man who invented reality TV, kind of by bugging people.
There was something kind of pervy and boundary crossing that isn't easy to sentimentalize.
I'm Mark Fennell, and that is just one exceptionally weird individual who changed the course of history, but trust me, there are more, and you'll hear about them. Just search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app.
This is The Book Show, where today, dust off that magic lamp. I have three literary wishes to grant you. We'll unpack a juicy love triangle with the American author Lily King. We'll pop on our bonnets to head to a meeting of the Jane Austen Society in Pakistan for our series Dear Jane. And first up, one of literature's biggest thinkers, Jeanette Winterson, will muse on storytelling, technology, and Aladdin's lamp. I'm your genie and your host, Claire Nichols. It's great to be here. When it comes to the intersection of literature, humanity, and technology, I don't know if anyone in the world has thought more deeply about this than Jeanette Winterson. Jeanette is the British writer best known for her novels Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit and Frankenstein, and her wonderful memoir Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal. For a long time now, Jeanette has been interested in tech and AI and what it means for us and the stories we tell. She's put these ideas and a lot more into a new book called One Aladdin, Two Lamps, which also tackles the famous text, 1001 Nights. Jeanette Winterson, welcome.
Hey, good morning. I'm so happy to be on your show. You know, I love coming to Australia when I get to come in May for the Sydney Writers Festival. I'm so happy. It's the spirit of the people. It's kind of upbeat, cheerful, can do, and I'm always welcome. So it's a great joy to have a little bit of Australia brought back into my kitchen this morning.
I was in Sydney at the same time as you, and there was this great photo circulating of you standing on a bookseller's table with your arms in the air. You looked like you were having a total blast.
Oh, I was. Because you see, you can do that with you guys and nobody thinks is going to cart you off to the lunatic asylum or, you know, treat you like you've really gone crazy. It's just part of life there. I was happy. I was enjoying myself.
I'm so pleased to hear it. So we're going to talk about this new book. It's called One Aladdin, Two Lamps. And I've been thinking about how we describe this, Jeanette, because it's not a novel.
No.
I'd almost call it an essay. Like, how would you describe it?
It doesn't really have any categories, which is, of course, what I like. You know, and when I wrote my first novel, Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, I was only a kid, I was only 25, and I used to go mad because people were always trying to label it and say, and I thought, this is just going to make it smaller. I thought, just read it, and then you can work out for yourself. I don't know, because it's a hybrid, isn't it? Because it's got fiction in it where I rewrite some of the stories from The 1001 Nights. Don't worry, folks, not all of them. You've got time. And then there are my comments on those things that are really personal stories about my life, because the overall theme of it is how do you tell the real from the counterfeit, which is a big question in this world. And I wanted to approach it, but I thought, I can't do it just using one thing from my toolkit. I need to bring things together. So it's an everything book.
Does that make life difficult for your publishers when they have to then figure out how to describe your book to other people?
Oh, yeah, I'm driving them mad. And it doesn't work for any prizes because prizes always work in categories. So nobody really knows what to say and they're a bit embarrassed. But at this stage, you know, after working for 40 years, I can pretty much do what I like because somebody's going to buy it, some poor fool. So I'm allowed to publish in my own way.
Okay, so one of the things I think this book is about reading and storytelling and why reading fiction matters. And Jeanette, I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about your early relationship with novels because they weren't allowed in your house.
No, absolutely not. I was brought up in as a Pentecostal, really in a cult atmosphere, and I was meant to be a missionary. I am a missionary, you can tell. It's just not for Jesus. And so Mrs. Winterson didn't want any secular books in the house. And of course, because I'm adopted, we didn't align in any particular way right from the get-go, because I was a cheerful child, endlessly curious, and she was a woman who just wanted the rules of life as given by the Bible. And she used to say to me, "The trouble with a book is that you never know what's in it till it's too late." And I used to think, too late for what? And that sent me shooting down to the library to see what hidden treasure was in these books. And in those days, because these were Carnegie libraries, paid for by the Scottish steel magnate, Andrew Carnegie, made a fortune in America and wanted every child to have a chance. You know, it was a lovely thing, really old-fashioned philanthropy, and we shouldn't knock it. And so he built libraries all over the world. And I used to go in there, and there's a gigantic bookshelf at the back that said English Literature in Prose, A to Z. And I had no one to help me, so I thought, well, I'll start at A. So I went rushing in. At the beginning, it cheers you up, doesn't it? Because you get Austin, the Brontes, Conrad, Dickens, Eliot. You know, it's quite good, and you can carry on well. It was only when I got to Nabokov that I faltered. But this was my early beginning. And it was really not having anything directed, but finding these astonishing worlds. And I realized within these worlds, which were absolutely not my world, a poor working class child in the north of England whose dad could only read by running his finger on the line, I thought, no, this isn't me. I'm not looking for me. I'm looking for the not me. I'm looking for the flying carpet. I'm looking for the magic lamp. I'm looking for the way out of the me. And that's how I found it.
Wow. So you write in this book, one of the things I love about fiction is that we can and do escape our fate. And I'm hoping you can explain what you mean here, Jeanette, because characters don't always escape their fate, do they?
By no means. And thank you for bringing this up, because it's a subtle point and it doesn't easily yield itself, you know, to a soundbite or an either or, because we live in a world of individualism where it's all down to you and you're worth it, and if you succeed it's all because of your amazing talents and grit and hard work, and if you fail you're just a loser, to quote a certain president. But really, it's more complicated than that, because as women discovered, there are things in this world called structural inequalities. You know, and if you're not given an education and you're not allowed to have any opportunities and you're not expected to do well, it's very hard to be the winner in life and to get ahead and forge ahead, because these things have traditionally been reserved for men. And it's only in the last 100 years that women have been able to realize that what happened in their environment would also affect them as people. If you've got no chances, you've got no choices. So I wanted to show that, yes, there is a way out for all of us, and it's in the life of the mind, the imagination, because everything that happens starts as an idea in your head. Every single damn thing just starts as something that doesn't exist in somebody's head. So there's always a chance. But also I wanted to talk about the deep unfairness of the world that we live in, and really also how to confront that. So it's not just I did it my way. It's also about how lucky I was to be brought up in the time that I was brought up in, a kind of golden age where there was feminism, where there was opportunity, where people believed in progress. I don't think we do anymore.
So maybe we can use you as an example here, Jeanette. How do you think that reading fiction has helped you to escape your fate?
Well, my fate would have been to work in a building society in Accrington, or get married, or maybe be a clerk, so it would have been something. Girls' worlds were very small in those days. You know, you could be a nurse, and nurses are wonderful, but you weren't encouraged to be a doctor. You're always encouraged to stay in your box. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to see what was really outside of all those boxes that were possible for me. And it was seeing in other lives as much what I didn't want to be. You know, 19th century fiction, largely written by men, is full of women whose lives fail and fall and nothing really works out for them. You know, in France, Madame Bovary, 1856, there's a new disease came out after that called Bovaryism. All the women who got it caught Bovaryism. And really it was because they realised that actually they weren't sex crazed or evil or bad wives or demented or needed pills and medication from their doctor. They realised that their lives were horrible and and they were forced to submit to endless boredom, obey their husbands, and everything was worthless and meaningless, and they thought it was just all about them. It was just me who feels like this. When they read Madame Bovary, they realized that this was the structural inequality. This was the state of life for women. You know, it was just like the 1950s, never mind the 1850s. And although within that novel, everything goes horribly wrong for the character Madame Bovary, those people who read it, just as we do now, were furious and indignant and realised, A, that they weren't alone, and B, that this was a problem that needed to be changed. It wasn't just about you. It was actually a social issue.
So sometimes the act of reading can be just going, oh, somebody else feels that way. That might be the starting point.
Exactly. Somebody else feels that way. And also, the world is not fair. It's not level. It doesn't all work out if you just do your best. You know, when I was in Accrington, I thought, a lifetime of hard work will never get me out of here. And that's what most people feel now. They think, damn it, I can't put food on the table for the kids. I can't afford to buy my own home. How can I possibly change my circumstances when everything outside of me is leveled against me? So many people feel that now, and that's wrong. What a mess we've made.
In this book, One Aladdin, Two Lamps, you pay really close attention to the story of the 1001 Nights. And of course, this is the famous story of Scheherazade telling those long stories to the Sultan in order to stay alive another night. Do you remember, Jeanette, when you first came across these stories?
Yeah, of course, I was a kid, and it was in my general secretive reading. And I had a version of it which was just the few stories that everybody in the West knows so well. You know, whether it's Aladdin, whether it's Ali Baba, Sinbad the Sailor, the story of the fisherman and the genie. You know, he lets the genie out of the bottle, grows to 300 feet tall, promises in everything, all of that sort of thing. Those stories that we know and love. And I saw Aladdin as a pantomime when I was a very little girl because my dad worked in a factory. And at that point, factory owners used to give children a party at Christmas. Factories were much smaller. And I saw it there in the north on the stage. And I thought, wow, because Aladdin is reading. And that gave me the clue. And that's when I wanted to find out much more about these stories told by a woman. She's the centre of it, unfolding through time, not beginnings, middles and ends, as we commonly think of as stories, but more like the way our minds work, moving back and forward in past, present and future. And so I found in there a very non-Western way of reading reality.
I guess there's not the traditional kind of hero's journey in these stories, right? It's not, here is a person fated to do well, they are going to make all the right choices and they are going to be successful. The stories in 1001 Nights don't really work like that.
No, you're right. They don't. I mean, Aladdin looks like a hero's story because he wins the princess, who's not called Jasmine, by the way. That's just a Disney version because we know these stories usually from the movies. And it looks like it's a hero story, but it's not, because what happens to Aladdin, as happens to everybody in the Nights who succeeds, the real thing is encounters with others. Who are you going to meet on this journey? Who's going to help you and who's not? And that is important. It's much more of a collective affair. And a great big dollop of good luck and, of course, a bit of magical endeavour from a genie. So nobody does go around saying, I did it my way and I am invincible, except tyrants and evildoers. You know, they're the ones who thinks it's all about them. We have parallels for this. The other ones, just the ordinary people, the little people who find their way somehow, really know that it is about encounters with others. And that's a great lesson for us in the West, because we're obsessed with this idea of the strong man, the hero, and it takes us away from, distracts from how we actually have to live, which is relational. We live with other people. It's not just about you.
We're not just the hero of the story.
No, we're not. And that's really hard in the West, because Dickens told us, didn't he, that, you know, you have to be the hero of your own life. And we love that. And it's true that you do have to take control and responsibility, take charge, have goals and aims. All of that is true. Of course you do. But you also have to understand that out there is a world and you are going to interact with it. Now, you can either just dominate it and just try and be the most powerful one, which has caused the kind of ugliness that we're in now, or you can work with others.
You've taken some of these stories and you've put your own Jeanette Winterson spin on them. How fun has it been to reinterpret these stories for a new audience?
Oh, I've loved it. You know, the best thing is to just take the stories and play with them, change the language. You know, I didn't take any liberties with how they actually work out, because those stories are there. But remember that they were all words begin in the mouth before they land on the page. And all stories, folk tales, fairy stories, wonder tales, start being told mouth to mouth, passed hand to hand. So they're oral before they're written down. And then when people translate them, new variants come in. So the thing is always sort of exuberant and moving and adapting, a bit like the human condition itself. We can adapt to anything. And so can stories, because the glory of stories is that they change. So I was able to go in there and work with them and tell them for a modern audience to make us laugh, to make us think, to do it in a way which isn't archaic, but to say, hey, look, these stories are about now.
Mm. Do you have a favourite of the stories of the 1001 Nights?
Well, it has to be Aladdin, doesn't it? Because I am Aladdin, of course. I mean, I'm not exactly an orphan because I did have parents. It's just that they abandoned me, never mind. But in there, the story of somebody who's just kind of a bit left out and a bit lost and has to find their own way, but of course does it through the help of others, was a story that really appealed to me. And because I needed a genie, you know, and people forget that if you get some sort of good luck or what looks like magical help, it doesn't really belong to you. It's not because you're special. These things can disappear immediately as well. And so I was within that story. Yeah, I was trying to craft and graft a way for me to change my circumstances. And I realized, you know, when I was in Accrington all those years ago, I thought, I can change the story because I am the story. And as soon as I read myself as a fiction as well as a fact, that I wasn't hemmed in and completely controlled by other people's narratives, I realized I could write my way out. And that's what I've been doing for the past 40 years.
So what's your genie been, do you think?
Do you know, I think for me, it has been encounters with others. When I think of the people along the way who have helped me, a teacher at school, Ruth Rendell, the crime writer who gave me a place to write, publishers who believed in me, the early women's presses that were just starting when I started out, people who came along and said, I'll give you a chance, don't come this way. And then, of course, you have to make the most of it. That's where the personal responsibility steps in. If you, you know, loads of people get chances and they don't even notice, and then they say, life's treated me so badly. It's not usually the case. You usually do get chances. And so for me, it's really been that, even though I'm quite a solitary person, you have to be as a writer because you spend all your time on your own. But out there, there's been people who've really, really helped me. And within that, I suppose, an unsquashable belief that the life of the imagination, I guess that's my genie, that could always create the kind of life that I wanted to live.
The whole idea of 1001 Nights is that it's a story that doesn't end. The storyteller has to keep telling this story so she's not beheaded in the morning. It means that no story really ends. The next one will begin. And I think that format works really well for this book, One Aladdin, Two Lamps, because it kind of allows you to jump from idea to idea as you go along, right?
Yeah, and that's how my mind works. I'm always jumping from thing to thing, and then we have to corral it so that people can actually read it. But the fact that it doesn't end is hopeful, it's optimistic. This is a woman who's filibustering for her life. In the morning, she will die. And the only way out is to tell a story that's so interesting that the Sultan wants it to go on the next night. And that's how she expands time. And here we are now, you know, in a world where the stories are looking really dark. They're really terrible. And if we start becoming doom-laden and believing that this is the end, that there is no better story to tell, that we're always going to live like this, then it will end. You know, this will be just a continuous ending of people getting more miserable, more unhappy. And that's what we have to be able to find some strength to fight against, I think. And it's strength that starts with the imagination. You know, there is not a more hopeless position than that which opens in 1001 Nights. This woman will die in the morning. The fact is she doesn't. And the glory of that, the hope of that, is imagination. You know, all I want to say to people is the way that we live on planet Earth, it's not a law like gravity. We're all subject to the law of gravity. There's nothing we can do about it. But that's not true of the way we live. The way we live is propositional. It's a story. It's a story that we are continually telling as we go along. That's how progress happens. We tell a better story. No, women aren't inferior. No, people of colour are not inferior. We start telling better stories, and we can do it now. And you find the truth of that, the evidence of that, and the strength for that when you go back to something like The Nights.
That's wonderfully hopeful, and thank you for that, Jeanette. Something that wasn't so hopeful was a line I pulled out of the book. You say, You ask if reading is going to be a part of the coming human journey. You say that you're confident we'll have music, we'll have visual art and moving pictures, but on reading, you are not so sure.
I'm not, because the evidence is pointing the other way. Obviously, it upsets me because we know that reading difficult things affects the brain, and it affects the brain in a good way. But maybe it's going. And if it is, then we shall have to face this and still find ways of not turning us all into trivial sound bites. You know, if we outsource everything, what's the point of being human? And it depends whether we want to be serious people, profound people, people who feel they have a destiny or a meaning on this planet, or if we just want to be trivial consumers who will take the next blandishments of social media or big tech and just become useless people. You know, in my hometown of Manchester, where the Industrial Revolution started, Marx and Engels were wandering around, and Engels looked at the factory system and he says, this is what happens when men regard each other only as useful objects, you know, hands to mind the machine. But now we're looking around and we're saying, this is what happens when we regard each other only as useless objects. Can we put everybody out of work? Can we get robots and AI to do everything? Well, who do we want to be? This is the big question. And weirdly, reading is part of it. Because when you read for yourself, you're not subject to whatever it is that other people want you to believe in the same way. You can read from several sources, amass the information, and make your own mind up in a way that you cannot when you're doing sound bites, BuzzFeed, social media. So it's pretty bad, but it might go.
So how do we lead this campaign, Jeanette? How do we get people passionate about reading deeply again?
Yeah, it's difficult because if it doesn't start when you're a kid, you have to be incredibly earnest and serious and driven to pick it up in later life. We know this. You have to believe in it. And I would like to have a huge campaign everywhere around reading to say, no, this is not a luxury item. You know, it's not like a handbag or a jet ski holiday. This is something which has shaped the mind of the human, and let's have it back, please. It's not elitist, you know, which is the way things are sold when somebody wants to destroy them. Don't bother with that. It's elitist. That's why tyrants burn books. Do you think they'd burn books if they thought they didn't matter? Reading matters. So what we've got to do is get some politicians, really I need to go into politics, to say, okay, these things matter. Now let's prioritise and let's put some money in there and let's show that this is fun, it's joyful, it's meaningful, it's how you make a life.
All right, well, I'm going to vote for you, Jeanette. Now, Jeanette, you're a writer who has thought really deeply about AI, and I want to get into this a little bit. But before we do, we should talk about the letters AI, because most of us think of the words artificial intelligence, but you see it differently. What are the words that come to your mind when you hear the letters AI?
Yeah, it's a bad word, isn't it? Artificial intelligence. I think of it as alternative intelligence. You know, artificial intelligence comes from the 1950s, John McCarthy. He was trying to differentiate from natural intelligence, which is what humans have. Obviously, in a world we live in where nothing is natural, the idea of artificial intelligence, I just think of AstroTurf, you know, and fizzy drinks. So it's really off-putting, isn't it? And it does sound weird and sci-fi and hostile. So we need to change that. It's a Cold War term, artificial intelligence. At present, let me be clear, all AI is a tool, and humans are tool-using animals. That's what it is. It's not thinking for itself. It's not sentient. There is no general intelligence out there coming from computing power. Really, we could call it all computational statistics, what we do now, but that's even less sexy than AI. But it may develop into something else. So it's not a tool, it's a player, something that's working alongside us. I believe this is our best chance, and I believe that, as usual, with our ingenuity, we're inventing the very thing that we need, and that's why I'm optimistic. For all the dangers, this is our best chance, because it's clear that we cannot go on as we are.
What about for writers, Jeanette? What does the advent of a possibly sentient AI mean for people who write novels for a living?
Well, we know that AI is good at generating slop, and there is already a lot of slop. But humans are pretty sloppy too. And let's say that you just want to read trashy airport novels, then AI can write those for you. Where there's no facility with language, there's no emotional understanding, there are no real ideas. They're just a formula, because that's what AI is great at doing. is why so much TV is bad right now. You know, you can sit there and think, how did I just waste 4 hours of my life watching TV? Because you're still empty. So it depends what you're looking for. If you just want to pass the time and get through your life until you die, then AI generated slot will do it for you. You'll never have to think about a thing. You'll never have to feel anything except maybe a bit of anger or desire for somebody. And you'll be like a pair of hot and cold taps. That'll be you. But I think human can do more than that. Human can be better than that. So again, it's do we push everything down to the lowest common denominator? Or do we accept that AI can do some things really well, but that we will go on being interested in what it means to be human, and we will want to have conversations with each other about things that matter?
Jeanette Winterson, it is always so invigorating to talk to you. Thanks so much for taking the time today.
Oh, thank you. I know we've been everywhere, but that's what happens. It's your fault. I've loved it.
And Jeanette's book is called One Aladdin, Two Lamps. It's published by Jonathan Cape. You're listening to The Book Show on ABC Radio National, where you simply must stick around for the latest instalment of our Jane Austen series, Dear Jane, where this time we are exploring Jane's worldwide appeal. But before that, here's a novel that's both a love triangle and a tearjerker. Heart the Lover is the sixth novel by the American author Lily King. It follows Jordan, a young woman at college who is torn between two men, Sam and Yash, who also happen to be best friends. The choices she makes will ripple through her life. Lily King is with Sarah Lestrange.
Lily, this is your sixth novel, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's a tearjerker.
I didn't expect it to be a tearjerker. I honestly didn't. I thought I was the only one who was crying when I wrote the first draft. So I was very surprised that other people felt the same way.
And are you a fan of tearjerkers?
I cry pretty easily. And so, you know, I don't chase a tearjerker, but I do like a novel to make me feel things. You know, whether it's joy or sadness or fear or anything. I mean, not fear so much. I'm not so crazy about fear.
I'm with you there. I mean, and I was thinking about it. What's the key to a good tearjerker? Because you don't want to feel manipulated, do you? But I think the key is that you need to care about the characters.
Yes, and I never anticipate that people will actually care about the characters. I all I can do is care about them myself. And, you know, as I go through the drafts, I just try to make them as real to me as possible. And then when they actually are real to other people, it kind of staggers me. And that people were really sad at a particular moment in this book, very consistently, has been so surprising to me.
And I think that the other factor, you know, caring about characters, I think time as well, because we're with these characters over 20 years. It's the book starts in college, which is such a formative period for so many people.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's a period that a lot of people can relate to. And so they sort of put themselves there as they're reading along. And it is funny because it's a short book. But it has these big leaps in time. And so you kind of make them with the character and then make this next leap as well. And I do think that just the passage of time alone is a very poignant thing. I mean, just the passage of time alone can make you cry. And so you don't have to do much. Once you get the passage of time, then you just have to, you know, tweak things, poke things just a little tiny bit, and there you have it, sort of nostalgia and remorse and all those kinds of things that come along with it, as well as loss.
Well, let's meet these characters. So it's the book Heart the Lover. It's narrated by Jordan, not her real name. And actually, she's a character from a previous book of yours, isn't she?
She is. I don't want to give too much away. but there is a tie, there is a link, connection to writers and lovers. And I didn't know that when I started writing this book. She was very much her own person.
What do you mean?
I didn't know. I didn't think about her name. It's in first person. And she meets these two guys, and then kind of three guys when she gets nicknamed. And
Jordan.
Jordan. I didn't really even think about it. They get it from The Great Gatsby because she used to play golf. And my memory is that I took a note in the back of my notebook of something that was going to happen way in the future. And I wrote down the name of her husband. That was how I first got the idea that this would be connected, is that it was a guy from Writers and Lovers. And I was like, what? She's married to him? And so that means that she's her. And I didn't know that. So that was a surprise to me.
Ha. I love it when a book can surprise the author.
Me too.
So Jordan's, you know, she's just really bright character. She's clever. She's spending time with other clever students. She plays golf briefly, as you say. That's how she gets her nickname. How did she come to you?
Well, I know that I was writing this political murder mystery and it wasn't going well. And my friend Ann Patchett sent me her manuscript of Tom Lake, and I started reading that. I read about 6 pages and I thought to myself, she is having fun and I am not having fun. How do I have fun? And I flipped to the back of the notebook that I was writing the political murder mystery in, and I just didn't care. I'd written 90 pages and I didn't care who did it. I didn't care about anything. And I just started writing this college scene. And I was just trying it out. And then I felt like, okay, this is a novel. I have something here. It wasn't until that moment where I really, really knew that I was going to keep going with that.
Okay, so Jordan, she gets her name from these other literature students at college, Yash and Sam. Let's take them one by one. Sam is this devout Christian. He doesn't believe in sex before marriage. Mm-hmm. Jordan is pretty cool with sex before marriage. I found Sam quite self-centered, I have to say. What were you aiming for with Sam?
Well, I really wanted a contrast between the two guys, and they are best friends, and they are very intellectually ambitious. They consider themselves sort of intellectually liberal and open-minded, except, you know, with Sam when it comes to religion. And it's hard for her because she has just become sexual. You know, she had her first sexual relationship the year before, and now she's very attracted to Sam. They don't talk very well together, but they are very attracted to each other. And yet he really makes her feel ashamed for sort of wanting sex and having sex. And so it's a huge tension between them. And Yash is kind of in the background, knowing probably some of this and watching it, and also sort of falling in love with her. And after a while, she starts to want to be in the house with Yash and not Sam. And so then it becomes a problem for them.
Yeah, a problem in the shape of a love triangle, yeah. Right?
I do like a love triangle.
What do you like about a love triangle?
I just love the tension. I love, it's just so much more interesting than, you know, kind of a meet cute where they like each other. And there's just, that's all nice and it makes you feel good as a reader, but it doesn't drive a story forward. And so I like that. I also feel like it kind of happens in life more often than you would think. It just seems like when you meet someone, you also meet someone else. And I don't know if that's because you're giving off some vibe of like, I don't care because I just met someone, so I can be completely myself with you. And then you find yourself in a love triangle.
Yeah. And as you say, it allows you to build tension, and you build the tension between Yash and Jordan just so beautifully, because there is resistance. Yash and Sam, they're best friends. And Jordan's just had this relationship with Sam. I mean, it's complicated.
Yes, it is complicated. And as we see as the novel moves on, we see how important their friendship is. And at the beginning, she doesn't really understand how deep a friendship it is. And in some ways, I think that friendship affects everything that happens to her, really. It's sort of a friendship that can't be broken.
Mm. So the love triangle, yeah, it's going in multiple directions, isn't it? It's not just going between the lovers. It's going between the friends as well.
It's really true.
So you're just as interested in friendship as in love.
I definitely am. I mean, this whole book is really about the many, many different forms of love and how love, you know, you might have a huge, big love in college, and that love can really transform to just a dear, dear friendship. And that's also about the love of a mother for her children, the love of husband and wife. Even though we don't see that husband-wife relationship very much in the book, but what you do see is incredibly intense and important. And I hope that it comes across to the reader as very, very strong.
And I think we need to discuss the title of your book, Heart the Lover. This comes from a card game. I don't know. Is it a real card game? I'm confused. Tell me.
I know. It's funny. So it is a card game that I learned from dear, dear old friends of mine probably 20 years ago when our kids were all really little and we played a lot of games. And so my friends are Joss and Alecta, and Joss's dad's dad taught Joss's dad this game in the 30s. And so they've been playing it in his family ever since. And nobody else is, you can't Google it. And what you can find online is a board game from the late 1800s called Sir Hinky Funny Duster. And so it looks like a board game. It looks very similar to this card game. And it's really a game of manners. And I think it was probably created to teach children how to say thank you, how to say please, how to say may I please, that sort of thing. And so you have to very prescriptively ask for a card. And if you get it wrong, everybody can scream, Sir Hinkum Funny Buster. And the first person who screams Sir Hinkum Funny Buster is their turn. And it sounds kind of silly, but it's actually really, really fun. And we've played it for years in our family. We have such a great time. And even my kids are now, you know, in their mid-20s. And my daughter, my younger daughter, Eloise, when I wrote the family group chat and said that I was going to call my new novel Heart the Lover, she wrote back immediately and she said, you cannot call your new novel Heart the Lover. You will ruin your career.
Why?
I think she thought Heart the Lover? I mean, well, like the word heart and lover in the same title. And so
because it's a strange combination. It syntactically doesn't quite flow.
Seems really cheesy, maybe. I don't know. She just hated it. And so I tried so hard to find something else because she has really good taste and she's lived in New York for 6 years and she's a fashionista and she has her finger on the pulse of everything cultural. And I was like, oh God, I can't name it that. But I never came up with anything better. And my editor and my agent loved it. And so we just went with it.
Because the characters are playing this game.
And the game
together.
Takes on the words, Heart the Lover, and the game itself really take on meaning as the story goes on. And as we make these leaps in time, it returns and it has power as these things do from the past. So it just made more and more sense that that was the name of the book.
Lily King with Sarah Lestrange and Heart the Lover is published by Canongate. Here on The Book Show, we are celebrating 250 years of Jane Austen with our series, Dear Jane. Last time, we were swept off our feet by the romance in Austen's Persuasion. And right now, Sarah Lestrange is back to think about how far Jane's influence has spread, because these are books that have travelled well beyond the Anglosphere. They are truly international in their appeal. Sarah, I've been thinking about matchmaking.
Ooh, tell me more.
Well, I've been reading Emma, Jane Austen's fourth published novel about the fabulous Emma Woodhouse.
Yes.
And yeah, I've been wondering, have you ever been a matchmaker?
No, I really can't say I have. But my marriage, it is the result of a setup by friends. So, I mean, maybe we're in good Jane Austen territory there.
Oh, okay. I need to learn more about that. But we should probably talk about Emma. She's such a complicated character. I love her. I think she'd be really fun to hang out with because she's handsome, she's rich, she's clever, she's witty and charming. But of course, she's also used to getting her own way. She's stubborn, maybe a little conceited. And her lesson in the novel is going to be she is going to learn to be more humble and she's going to learn that she can't always get what she wants.
Oh, drat. I really warmed to Emma because of this very fact, because she is flawed. And Claire, Emma is certainly a favourite of Laaleen Sukeyra, who grew up reading Jane Austen in Pakistan. And Laaleen, you took this passion for Jane Austen to a whole new level over a decade ago.
I'm the founder of the Jane Austen Society of what was first Pakistan, but is now the Middle East, North Africa, and Pakistan. So we've grown a little bit. It grows with me.
You're taking over.
Well, I don't know if it's taking over, but I would say that there's a lot more people that are interested in Austen's world and have an affinity with her novels and characters than most people think in different regions of the world. And I don't know. It just happened very organically. And we had a little tea party. Some of my friends came and some people I didn't know. So it was like a mix of people. This was in Islamabad when I used to live there. And the photos got really popular. And I would say they went viral in some circles in the Jane Austen universe. And just took off.
And Claire, the members of the Jane Austen Society in Pakistan, get this, you'll love it. They even dress up.
Awesome. I do love a good bonnet. I do worry if I was in the society, I would get totally carried away trying to dress like the perfect Austen heroine.
I've actually mostly worn things that are in my actual wardrobe, but it's not that difficult to improvise. I've also purposefully bought certain things. I've dressed up as Mr. Darcy once myself as well. I was just tired of nobody doing that. But you know, you just need a high-waisted Empire line dress, and then you can cinch it in the waist there. You wear at a bolero and a shawl, some gloves, put your hair up. I mean, it's really not that difficult.
And of course, Emma is a style icon too. What do you relate to with this heroine, Laaleen?
You know, I relate to so many things about Emma. And first of all, she's not a very popular heroine, but I find her appealing. And what I like about her is she didn't need to get married. She's the only heroine who actually did not need to get married. She just did it because she wanted to. And there's this independence and freedom in that, you know, not feeling compelled. Her father certainly didn't want her to get married. And she certainly didn't need it for her continuity as well into adulthood and old age. She was independent. So that's one thing I really like about her. And I know she meddled a lot in people's lives, but she did mean well. And she did learn along the way. So I think she has a lot of redeeming qualities. And yes, I have played Cupid my entire life. And I've even become a matchmaker in the last couple of years. So I actually do. And I've also lived with my dad, who's widowed. So I relate to her in so many ways.
I love this idea of these Austen-esque afternoon teas in Islamabad. And I guess the appeal makes sense, right? Because Pakistan is a former British colony.
Yeah, and Laaleen herself comes from this wealthy background. So she was mixing in a crowd equivalent to the aristocracy in Austen's Regency England. And she grew up speaking English and also reading the British canon. It's part of her everyday life. Laaleen, I'm wondering when you noticed these parallels between these two seemingly very different worlds.
So I didn't actually notice them until I started college. So I was I went to college in the States, and the settings and the dialogues and the sort of social construct and context of what was modern day Pakistan back then in you know, the mid to late 90s and early 2000s versus the 19th century, there were so many parallels, you know, the drawing room society and sort of the marriage market and the emphasis on people's background and ancestry and, you know, marriages being brokered between families. And then, of course, you know, as I became older and then I realized, okay, the society was, you know, the upper classes, more decadent, you know, your own social codes, various forms of etiquette. All of this was very relatable and perhaps so much more relatable than to, like, say, the modern American, you know, to whom tea time wasn't a norm, but they considered it, oh, it's very posh and very fancy. And I'm like, actually, no, not really. It's just part of life. We just have tea time. So we don't just see her as frothy and an escape. Enjoyable, yes. Relatable, yes. But also she hits the very core of what most of us know and understand. Like, you just automatically, it doesn't need to be explained to you. You just know it instinctively. Oh yeah, of course. That's how people think. That's what mothers say. That's what aunts behave. That's how men behave. That's how their mothers behave. You know, it's just sort of, not a revelation. It's just there. It's a reflection rather.
That is so fascinating to think that Austen's world might make more sense to a reader in Pakistan than it does to an American, for example, and maybe also to an Australian audience too.
Yeah, honestly, there are times when I was reading Emma and I just didn't recognise it. But it's not just Pakistan, you know. There's a Jane Austen Society in Japan, in Brazil, Mexico, Italy. I feel like Jane Austen unites rather than divides.
And, you know, it's been so interesting rereading all these Austen novels right now because I think, Sarah, when I was younger, I was so caught up in the romances, right? This time, I was really struck by how tenuous these women's lives are. And Laaleen's made it clear Emma is pretty independent, but for Austen's other heroines, their future depends on a good marriage. If something goes wrong, these women, they might not have a decent place to live.
Yeah, so even though Emma, you know, it's this quite light-hearted story about matchmaking, if you think about the position of 17-year-old Harriet Smith, who Emma takes under her wing as a sort of project, ultimately everything depends on Harriet being married well.
Yeah.
But she can't have her sights set above her station or too far below. It's this sort of delicate dance all around expectations on women. And Laaleen, this is something you really relate to as well.
Absolutely. There's this line that translates from Urdu and it's what will people think? And you grow up hearing that line and then you get so fed up of that line. And that line was memed as well at women's rights marches in Pakistan and the major cities because people are really fed up with it. And I don't think Gen Z really takes to it very well either. But my generation, you know, I'm 48 years old, so I've seen sort of both sides of that coin. And all of that, like social pressures, what will people think, getting married by a certain age, having a child by a certain age. You go from your parents' house to your husband's house. And even for men, by the way, most of them still live with their parents their entire lives. They actually never get to move out. So people are very dependent. Families are very close-knit. And I think the positives and the negatives are sort of interweaved with each other. There's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of expectations. But then again, women, young women increasingly write their own narratives. But it's really nice to have sort of Jane Austen there who understands where you're coming from and what a big deal it is if you've actually gone off on your own and achieved something for yourself.
We're celebrating 250 years of Jane Austen here on The Book Show. I'm Claire Nichols and Sarah Lestrange, we're joined by Laaleen Sukera, who set up the Jane Austen Society of Pakistan.
And I don't know about you, Claire, but reading Jane Austen for this series, I thought about which character I would be. But of course, I'm a middle-aged woman now, so I've aged out of any of the younger characters. What about you? Who would you be?
Oh, gosh. In Emma, maybe I would be Miss Bates.
No!
because I'd, You know me, I love nattering away excited about everything, maybe not knowing how to read the room and when to stop talking. I love her. I think she's gorgeous.
Yeah, but you're the least like Miss Bates of any person I know. If anyone, you are, Emma, because you're fun to be around, you're chatty, you're social. But anyway, that's also something we can talk about later. But do you remember that moment when Emma is really rude to Miss Bates? She really humiliates her publicly. That's heartbreaking, that scene, isn't it?
Yeah, and of course it comes to Mr. Knightley to have to call her out on that. Mm. I do think there is something there, though. We've had these moments in life, right, where we've said something cruel to someone without even really noticing. And yeah, I love the way that Austen, you know, from over 200 years ago, can speak to us today.
Yes, we return to Austen for everything to do with behaviour and good behaviour. And Lalene Sequeira, we need to know now, which Austen character would you be?
I suppose I would be Mrs. Bennet. I have three daughters. But the thing is, I'm not obsessed about their marriage. I'm like, please, let's wait till you're at least 30 and then you can decide if you even want to. First, you know, have a full life, have a brilliant education. You know, things that we learn in our lifetimes and things we wish we were told. I lost my mother at a young age, but you know, her words have always stayed with me, and she was really into education and standing on your own two feet, but also, you know, building a family, having a happy marriage. But not all of us can have a happy marriage. I'm divorced. So, you know, in addition to that, I have empathy for people that happened to in her novels, say Maria Bertram. She gets ostracized from society. She lives on the fringe of society in Mansfield Park. I mean, there are people who, you know, she's presented them in a very modern way without being judgy about them. And I like that.
Oh, Maria Bertram. So she's from Mansfield Park. And of course, she's the character who kind of like has her cake and eats it too. She marries boring Mr. Rushworth because she knows that's the right thing to do. But then she goes and has a fling with Henry Crawford. And then, of course, in true Austen style, she pays the price for her behaviour, Sarah. She's shunned by society and lives alone with the dour Mrs. Norris for company. But I have to say, I totally understand why she goes for Mr. Crawford. Those two, they have chemistry.
Oh, me too. And he's fun. And, you know, the heroes in Austen, they are nothing without the cads. Mm-hmm. We need the cads. They're kind of this counterbalance, don't you think, to the serious heroes like Mr. Knightley or Mr. Darcy. And, mm-hmm. you know, quite frankly, I'm with you, Claire, in Mansfield Park. Henry Crawford is a lot more interesting than Fanny Price's eventual flame, Edmund Bertram.
Her cousin.
Yeah, or Maria Bertram's Mr. Rushworth. Mm-hmm. They really do make the heroes look more noble.
They do. And the cads are actually very attractive. And, you know, I have literally fallen for her cads myself. So, you know, I've learned as well along the way. Okay, that's a red flag. Yeah. So, you know, it's a journey. We're still learning, students of life. But that's the beauty of Austen's novels. You can pick them up at any time of your life and you see something else that you didn't see when you were younger. And as you get older, you appreciate it more and more. You can read it as a comedy, you can read it as a romance, but you can also read it as, you know, I wouldn't say a playbook on how to live your life, but there's some very good lessons in there and there's some hard truths for a lot of people in South Asia, the Middle East, Muslim countries. I mean, where the son of the house inherits everything and the daughters are not really part of the plan. They're just meant to be married off.
Lalene Sequeira, thank you.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be part of this.
And Sarah Lestrange, this has been so much fun.
We can't get enough of talking about Jane Austen. And next time, I really can't wait for this, Claire, Karen Joy Fowler, one of my favourite authors. She wrote this novel inspired by our dear Jane, the Jane Austen Book Club.
Yeah, we're going to be diving into the world of Jane Austen adaptations to find out why writers keep returning to this 250-year-old author.
She never gets old, Claire.
And don't wait to listen to the whole series. In the words of Jane Austen, silly things do cease to be silly if they are done by sensible people in an impudent way. Happy birthday, dear Jane. That's the book show for today. Thank you to producer Sarah Lestrange and to operator David LeMay. We make this program for ABC Radio National on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people. And you can find the rest of our series, Dear Jane, and all the previous episodes of the book show on the ABC Listen app.
Hello, book show listener. Jane Austen, 250 years on. Dear me. Jonathan Green here from Every Bite, and I'm prepared to bet that the book show has not covered one fundamental ingredient in the novels of our Jane. You guessed it, the food. That's what we're here for. So if you have a hankering to know what happens in the Austen culinary universe, check it out on Every Bite.
I feel like, you know, that there's that idea of an amuse-bouche, that kind of little French beautiful thing that you pop in your mouth and it kind of explodes with flavour. And that's really what she's doing. Every tiny little mention of food does a huge amount unpacking what is food doing in Georgian society.
Find Every Bite in this episode, Soup and Sensibility, at the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.